You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Tell me, Graham, why did you really come here?
What are you asking for, Graham? My confession?
Just the truth.
Now we're straying into forbidden territory.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so you don't miss out on future episodes. Ben Brown is the writer of A Splinter of Ice, a play that portrays the meeting of one of the greatest novelists of the 20th century, Graham Greene, and his old MI6 boss, Kim Philby, one of Britain's most notorious spies and traitor. Graham Greene never divulged any details of the meeting, and Ben's play imagines what might have been. We discuss the play, as well as how Philby and Greene's lives were intertwined. The play is set in Moscow in 1987, and it's a story of two men catching up on old times, but with a new world order breaking around them. How much did the writer of The Third Man know about Philby's secret life as a spy? And did Philby betray his friend, as well as his country? Cold War Conversations listeners can watch the play for only £12, discounted from £20. Just go to our episode notes at coldwarconversations.com/episode186. If you've listened so far, I know that you are enjoying the podcast, so I'm asking for one-off or monthly donations to support my work and enable me to continue producing the podcast. If you become a monthly supporter, you will get the sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a thank you and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If a financial contribution is not your cup of tea, then you can still help us by leaving written reviews wherever you listen to us, as well as sharing us on social media. It really helps us get new guests on the show. So, back to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome Ben Brown to our Cold War conversation. I'm really pleased to have you on the show. I mean, Kim Philby is a very enigmatic character in the Cold War, and I very much enjoyed A Splinter of Ice. I felt it did give some real insight into Philby and his motives, and obviously also the relationship with Graham Greene. Now, what drew you to this story in the first place?
Well, it actually came about because I was interested in Graham Greene. And I, funnily enough, actually, it was in a book by David Lodge called Lives in Writing. There was a reference to Graham Greene, and I think it was a reference to him knowing Kim Philby. So I followed this up by reading the memoir of Graham Greene's partner for the last 30 years of his life, Yvonne Cloetta. And in that memoir, I found a whole chapter about Greene's relationship with Philby, which as I had not heard of before. And I've since discovered that very few people have heard of. People know about Graham Greene and they know about Kim Philby, but they don't tend to know, most people, that Graham Greene had worked for Philby, under Philby in MI6 during the war. And that also, yes, that he defended him when he defected and then actually gone to see him. And in Moscow in 1987, sort of the only person to do so really from Britain. And that was really my way into the play.
But Greene was quite cagey about what was said in that meeting.
That's right, yes. He, in fact, I recently discovered that he kept a diary on this 1987 trip to Moscow, and he He didn't even put in his own personal diary that he was going for dinner with Kim Philby. But it is absolutely documented. I mean, there were, you know, postcards and things, from letters between them. Also, Rufina Philby, Philby's fourth wife, who was also at this dinner. She later, in the late 90s, she wrote a memoir and also referred to this trip. So it absolutely happened. But yes, Green was very tight-lipped about it. He did say later in the year to a journalist that all he would say about it is that we drank and conversed about the past was all he would say. So there was quite a lot of room, yes, for my imagination to try and put my sort of best guess of what might have happened.
It is fascinating because I'm familiar with the Philby story. I was aware of Green's relationship with him because I knew that he wrote the foreword to Philby's 1968 memoir, My Silent War. So I was aware of that, but this meeting is a really interesting subject because when it occurs is glasnost has started. Gorbachev has been in power, I think, for 2 years at this point. And, you know, things are changing in the Soviet Union.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was actually the kind of honeymoon period of those glasnost, perestroika, Gorbachev reforms before, you know, it all went wrong for Gorbachev. It was, yes, this sort of time of optimism in terms of the thawing of the Cold War. In fact, Green's, the real sort of catalyst for the meeting on February 15th, 1987, was that Gorbachev had invited Green to this peace conference that he'd organized, in which lots of Hollywood celebrities as well and famous writers all descended on Moscow for this peace conference for a sort of nuclear-free world and the survival of humanity. It was a sort of rather grand title. And so Green went to that. And then it was in the evening that he thought he'd look up his old friend, Kim Philby. Green went four times to Moscow in this period. He went actually in 86 and 87 and 88. And I think it was in 88 that Philby died. But, you know, so the most interesting one to me was this one when they had this real chance to be alone together there at this meal when Philby's wife was also there but was sort of left them to it for most of the evening. And so that's why I've sort of focused on that one for the play.
And how much did you know about Philby?
Well, I was aware of Philby. I mean, apart from anything else, there have been lots of plays, of course, written about the Cambridge spies, TV dramas, and so forth. But I rather thought the subject had been, I assumed the subject had been kind of done to death. You know, Alan Bennett, of course, wrote plays about Guy Burgess and Anthony Blunt, and Simon Gray wrote a play about Blake, and there were other plays as well. But I was aware of it, but it was really this Philby himself had never been put on stage. And I do find him the most interesting. I think he was really the most important. He got the sort of highest up in MI6. You know, he was head of counter-Russian intelligence, and he was our man in Washington and very close with the CIA. So he really, and then people, it's widely accepted he probably would have become C, you know, head of MI6, had he not been exposed. So I was very interested in that. And also, yes, this angle with this relationship with Graham Greene, who was someone who's, one of the great novelists of the 20th century and the author, of course, of the classic film, The Third Man. So that was just too enticing to put, and he's never been put on stage, Graham Greene. So that sort of duologue, two-hander between them was particularly tempting for me. A key part of the play is the film of The Third Man, because of course, it was a great irony. The film came out in 1949, and in 1951 was when Burgess and MacLean defected. And of course, it was all over the press in Britain and America, particularly the hunt for the third man. Who was the third man in the spy ring? And so it was, which of course turned out to be Philby. But Green, of course, couldn't have known this when he wrote The Third Man, but it's a great irony and that he became the third man after, you know, Green had made that phrase so famous in his film. And in fact, Philby was convinced that the film was a kind of warning, a sort of secret warning to him, and that Green was sort of knew what he was up to in his portrayal of Harry Lyme, which Orson Welles, of course.
And Philby also had a link with Vienna, although a decade before, didn't he?
Yes, that's right. Because so Philby, he became a communist at Cambridge, as you know, he was at Trinity College, as Burgess was, as Blunt was, and in the early 30s. And then in 33, I think it was, yes, straight after his finals, he went to Vienna to fight against the fascist regime of Dollfuss. And sort of same time as just when the Nazis had come to power in Berlin. And so, yes, he went to Vienna, and then, you know, in fact, he used to use the sewers, which became so famous in the film of The Third Man, that he and his girlfriend at the time, who he later married, became his first wife, would sort of help smuggle people against the regime, out of Vienna through those sewers. And that is another thing that fed into, and he told Green about this. He says when they were, you know, lunching together in the early 40s, when they were, Green had come back from Africa, from Sierra Leone, and they were working for MI6, which was at that time had moved out to St. Albans. And yes, you know, he was, this all fed into his fixation that The Third Man had been based on him and had been sort of informed by his experience.
I interviewed somebody a while back, and I'm just trying to recall their name, but they had met Litzy Friedman, Philby's first wife. And I think this was in the 1980s when she was living in East Germany. And he did ask her about Philby. And I think all she would say is that he was a very nice man.
Really? That's very interesting. Well, yes, his third wife, Eleanor, his American wife, who he sort of left without warning in Beirut when he defected in 1963. She also, though, continued to speak well of him, as she did in her memoir, The Spy I Loved. So his relationship with his second wife, who his English wife, Eileen, didn't sort of end so happily. But she then died shortly after he went, sort of essentially left her and his five children and went when he went to Beirut in the mid to late 50s.
I guess if you're in that game of espionage, you've got to have some charm.
Well, everybody sort of says this about Philby, that he was enormously charming. Green certainly says this, you know, and the sense he had a great sense of humour, and he was sort of, he was very witty, and he sort of he stuck up for people within MI6. So Green, I've forgotten what the mistake was, but he'd got something wrong and could have been in a bit of trouble, but Philby, his boss, sort of covered for him. And this created a sort of loyalty and affection amongst all those below him. And he was thought by those above as well, they were thought enormously high of him. He was enormously intelligent and efficient and hardworking, as well as this personal charm that he clearly possessed. And you know, and the women in his life as well felt so drawn to, including, of course, notoriously Melinda McLean, Donald McLean's wife, after he'd defected to Russia. And when Eleanor eventually joined him from Beirut, she discovered this relation, this affair, and sort of promptly sort of left, saying she'd only come back when that ended. But then she shortly died of cancer. That was the sorry end to that.
In the play, they're almost parrying the Green and Philby character, particularly at this at the start of it, because they haven't seen each other for quite some time.
35 years.
Yeah, and obviously Philby's a little bit wary. He's there. And, you know, there's this uncertainty. And then as the play moves on, they sort of warm, or Philby warms to Green, because the initial thing is, you can't ask me any questions.
Yes. Well, that is actually, he as you say, I mean, he did, you know, this is recorded, I think, by Rufina Philby in her memoir, that, you know, that the, pretty much the first thing Philby said to Green when he got there after 35 years of not seeing each other and not seeing each other since he Philby had defected and his secret life, as it were, had come to light. The first thing he says, yes, please just don't ask me any questions. And that, so that is actually, he did actually say that. So, you know, which obviously to a very curious novelist like Green, who is so fascinated by the spy world and had written, you know, films and novels about it, was rather frustrating. So, but in my play, at least, he eventually overcomes this shyness and reticence on Philby's part by sort of winning his confidence that, you know, he's really just interested and wants to understand, you know, this Philby in his life.
And I think that works really well, because you get a really good description of his life in the play, because there's obviously the conversation moves on to Litzy and Philby's work in Vienna. But also, and I think this isn't particularly well known either, is his involvement in the Spanish Civil War, when he's having to act as a right-wing journalist because he's already been recruited by the Soviet intelligence at this point, and he gets awarded a medal by General Franco.
Yes, so as you say, he was covering for the Times, in fact, the Spanish Civil War, when a Republican shell blew up next to the car he was in. And this is, you know, extraordinarily, he became known as Lucky Kim. He was the only survivor. The other three journalists were all killed. So yes, Franco gave him a medal for that. And all of this, of course, was very useful for his cover as a sort of, you know, establishment, right-leaning, journalist and sort of patriotic Brit.
Yeah. Yeah, that gave him that protection, because he's recruited by MI6.
Yes, the crucial point then in 1940-41, it was finally getting into the security services. I'm not sure, actually, he may have joined MI5 first, but anyway, this, of course, would have always been the aim and always been his kind of orders, if you like, since he'd been recruited back in 1933. On a park bench in Regent's Park, by his Russian handler. So yes, that was the key turning point, in which, yeah, he's obviously stopped being a journalist at that point, and became a member of the security services and a sort of rapidly rising one.
But I think the interesting thing is about the vetting that they had for the security services during this period, because if it had been done reasonably thoroughly, they would have discovered his communist credentials. And I think some people were aware that he had, well, I think the view was that he'd flirted with communism as a sort of youthful aberration, but he was now, firmly part of the establishment.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose you have to, it seems incredibly naive, obviously, because, as you say, I mean, they did know the deputy head, the deputy chief of MI6, knew, you know, they knew about his, they knew he'd been a communist at Cambridge. But they did, so many people had, though. So they tended to see it as a sort of going through the measles thing that so many people had done, a youthful aberration, you know, as his father put it. And because absolutely, there was this occasion when this deputy chief took his father and Philby out to lunch at his club, or invited them to lunch, And then when Philby was in the loo, the chief asked his old friend, Philby's father, who was...
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
A famous Arabist, about this, his communism, Philby's communism at Cambridge. And he says, yes, it's just a youthful aberration. And the chief went back, the vice chief, sorry, went back to the head of MI6 and said, Philby's clean. I know his people. So sort of, yes, he had that little childish thing. But he's, now absolutely, he's rock solid now. And of course, by this time, we are after, of course, the Nazi-Soviet pact, which did cause many people to abandon their communism because, they were so appalled that Stalin should do a deal with Hitler, because fascism being the great enemy, that it was plausible, therefore, it seemed to them that Philby would long since have renounced his communism.
There is a conversation in the play about the Nazi Soviet pact and
exactly.
how Philby felt about that.
Mm.
Which again, the play I did so enjoy because the casting was great and the conversation, didn't feel contrived in any way. It felt like a natural conversation between two friends, and at some points you sort of almost forgot that it was supposed to be Kim Philby and Graham Greene. There was a genuine friendliness and affection came across.
Well, I mean, thank you for that. But there really was this genuine affection between them. This was the sort of the key to their relationship that at this time in the early 40s. Working together, Green under Philby, in St. Albans, and in this office there in King Harry Lane, and going to this King Harry pub for drinks and Sunday lunch and all of this, and that carried on actually when the MI6 moved back to London a bit later in the war. So this sort of time, in that wartime period, they really forged a very close friendship, and they just got on. They were both incredibly razor sharp men, and they shared a sense of humour. Of course, they shared a sort of background, public school in Oxbridge. So they had a lot in common, and they just really got on. And so that sort of, once you have that, or people have that sometimes in their youth, even if there's been a big gap, they can pick up the threads again, based very much on the humour and the shared interests as well. Of course, and Graham Greene, was leftish as well. Although, and he had in fact been, unlike Philby, ironically, he had in fact been a member of the Communist Party at Oxford, but only for 4 weeks, he says, and just as a sort of joke to try and get a free trip. But also, I mean, Graham Greene, he really had put himself out for Philby. This book came out, I think it was in 67, 68, called The Spy Who Betrayed a Generation by some Sunday Times journalists, with a really vicious introduction from John le Carré when he described Philby as having no woman, no home, no faith, and being spiteful, vain, and murderous. And so it was really strong stuff, and saying that Philby should have been, they should have, instead of allowing him to escape, whether they intentionally did or not, and when he defected in 63, that they should have liquidated him in Beirut, MI6 should have done. So, it was really going it. And Green then, I think, wrote some article in The Observer defending Philby, who he saw as a latter-day Elizabethan martyr, so that he, this was, as far as he was concerned, a sincerely held belief that communism would be better for Britain. And therefore, even if you disagreed with it, in Green's case, he respected it. So, he had taken a huge amount of flak for this, Green. People say it cost him the Nobel Prize, it cost him a knighthood, all these things. And, you know, he really was a lone voice of defence. So he'd really stuck his neck out for Philby. So I think Philby was very grateful for that, you know, that Green had been his defender, or as others would say, apologist. So, you know, there were reasons for them to, for this affection and this sort of friendship to have survived. And as you say, our casting is wonderful because, they are two of the great stage actors we have, Oliver Ford Davis and Stephen Boxer, both, you know, numerous leads for the RSC and the National and so forth. And they are old friends themselves, though. And they've, you know, 10 years ago, they did a David Edgar play written on the heart together. And they lived 20 years ago. I mean, they're old friends. So I think that really helps that in their playing, that they can, you know, in their portrayal of this other great old friendship.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that is questioned within the plays is why Green left MI6. And in fact, Philby asks this question in the play, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And so, yes, so what happened, yes, towards the end of the war, Philby, having already pulled off the initial coup of getting into the security services, then pulled off the coup of the Cold War was just beginning, and the counter-Russian intelligence sort of section was created. And it was assumed, I think, that Philby's boss, Felix Cowgill, would head up this new section. But Philby managed to get himself this job of being head of this new counter-Russian section. As Green said, you know, or says in the play, so, you know, he was given responsibility for catching himself. So, but at the time, this Green sort of seeing this sort of what he thought was naked, ambition to sort of climb to the top of the pole rather put Green off Philby. And this is what he says anyway. And so when Philby then offered Green a job in this section, he turned it down. That's the reason that Green does give, I think, in the foreword to My Silent War, Philby's memoir, for why he left MI6. Others have suggested, in fact, that he was also, you know, I think it was a film contract, and he wanted to kind of pursue his writing more now the war was ending full time. So there may have been something of that as well. But he certainly at that point, was rather put off Philby. But then in 1963, when he discovered, in fact, Philby had been ordered by his communist masters to get as high as he possibly could in MI6, and certainly, you know, heading up the Russian counterintelligence section was ideal from their point of view. Then for Green, that made Philby more sympathetic, because he felt he was at least, you know, he was working for a cause and an ideal rather than his own selfish motives.
Did you read any of their correspondence to sort of like get a feel as to, well, how they spoke in the written form anyway?
Yes, no, I did. One of the first things I did was I sent off to get photocopies of all of the kind of cards and letters between them. There aren't a great number, actually, but I think they're in the University of Georgia in America. So I got these photocopies, and that was helpful. But also, of course, Green's foreword to My Silent War, My Silent War itself, Philby's memoir, and Rufina's book as well, I think it's called The Private Life of Kim Philby, which is very useful. And I should also mention that there's a very good documentary called A Spy Who Went Into the Cold, I think it is, a BBC documentary by George Carey, who also made fine documentaries about George Blake and Guy Burgess. But that was very useful. And in The Spy Who Went Into the Cold, he actually goes into a flat in Moscow, KGB flat, where they lived and where the play is set, and interviews Rufa, as she was known, in that flat. And she sort of shows him around. So, of course, that was terrifically helpful for me writing a play set there. So, yes, that was some of the research, but of course there are many biographies and other ones that I read.
And is Rufina still alive?
She is, actually. She is still alive. She is, I think she's in her late 80s or something now. Yes, so we did actually make contact, but she, even though she spoke all the time to Philby in English, she seems to have forgotten all her English now. he you know, he's been dead for over 30 years, isn't it? So, and but we just got the sense as well that she'd rather be left alone. So we decided not to trouble her. And I think she'd put pretty much everything she could remember. She was certainly, you know, very fond of Graham Greene on these few occasions that she met him. And she put everything into this book and in this interview. So we decided to let sleeping dogs lie. But of course, you know, I don't know if she'll ever see the play. But I hope she'd, I think she'd think it was a more sympathetic portrayal of her late husband than certainly one that someone like Le Carré would give.
Yeah, well, yeah, you touch on Le Carré, don't you, in the dialogue as well, where there's no love lost there.
No. I mean, and actually, and this isn't in the play, but Green and Le Carré fell out a bit over Philby as well. I mean, it's interesting. The Carré aspect is interesting because Green and Philby were two of the most important figures in his life. And I know when he gave that interview a few years ago, it was reshown recently with Mark Lawson, he spoke about both of them. He admired Green enormously as a writer, obviously. And Philby, he famously based the traitor in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy on. And he also, in fact, blamed Philby for blowing his own cover and causing him to leave MI6 in 63. So when Le Carré had been based in Bonn, in the embassy in Bonn. It was a personal reason as well. It was very understandable loathing of Philby.
I know that Kim Philby's granddaughter Charlotte is a successful author.
I gather. Yeah.
And she's written a book about her grandfather and Edith Tudor Hart, which I'm very much looking forward to because, you know, I just do find this whole, well, the Cambridge Five, I think, are fascinating anyway, and you've got a great cast of characters there. I mean, Guy Burgess is you could write volumes about him, and indeed I've interviewed Andrew Lowney, who wrote the book on relatively recently on Burgess, and that was a fascinating chat. But I think it's difficult for people to think back and, you know, at the time when Philby was recruited in the 1930s, there was a polarization, or there appeared to be a polarization in politics between fascism and right-wing politics and communism. And it was easy for people to be seduced by communism and think that that was the way to a far better world. And With Philby, it seems as though he despite you know, as we've mentioned, the Stalin Hitler pact, Hungary in 1956, Czechoslovakia in 1968, he still was a true believer in communism.
Yes, he certainly said he was, and you know, appears to have been. He was a great fan of Gorbachev, actually. So I think he was attracted to what was sort of called in sometimes, wasn't it, the sort of communism with a human face. So, he wanted more openness You know, he certainly was not a fan of the Brezhnev era, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan and so forth. So, I mean, people have pointed out, though, that once you make a decision like that, and once you end up in Russia, and you're really a sort of state beneficiary, you know, there are other incentives, you know, not to give up the creed as well, aren't you? You're sort of tied to it, really, to that kind of commitment. But I think, I mean, that, you know, that might be all unconscious stuff. Certainly, he seems to have held fast to the faith consciously, or certainly that's what he told Green, and Green believed that. Le Carre, actually, in this introduction to The Spy Who Betrayed a Generation in 1968, said he didn't believe in the political motive of Kim Philby. He just thought he was sort of, you know, addicted to deceit and so forth. So he clearly didn't accept that, the sincerity of Philby's beliefs. But Green definitely did, which was crucial to their friendship. And as you say, though, about that time in the early 30s, you know, the rise of fascism in Germany, and of course already in Italy and in Spain, and the hunger marches that perhaps some of them even passed through Cambridge, you know, after that with the Depression. So, you know, the politics sort of seemed to be failing, and so many people, intelligent thinking people, did think that the only way to fight fascism was with communism. Obviously, people like Keynes were seeking a sort of third way, sort of social democratic kind of politics. But many did, you know, were drawn at that time in the mainstream in the West, and certainly in Britain, and particularly Cambridge.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, once he's in the Soviet Union, he's got nowhere else to go, so he has to toe the line there if he's going to live comfortably. And I don't know whether – have you seen the talk that he does for the Stasi?
Yes, I have. This one that was only discovered a few years ago, wasn't it?
That's incredible, because he's obviously thinks that this is never going to be shown outside of the Stasi or the Eastern Bloc espionage circuit. And so it's the real him.
Yes, it is absolutely fascinating. As you say, that a few years ago, I remember seeing Gordon Carrera introducing it, didn't he? This very short film of him speaking to the Stasi. I think he was in the very early 80s, wasn't it? Something like that.
Yeah.
And just, you know, because he'd sort of gone over to lecture or given them some tips. But to see that, the other famous film of him, of course, is when he's denying being the third man, really, in 1955, I think it was, in his mother's flat.
Yeah.
In Kensington or somewhere. But then, you know, we don't have any, but it's just only recently, yes, this much later film. So he would have been in his late 60s, even. Yeah. Anyway, with this film, so to sort of hear his voice, this very deep, rich voice that he had then. But still, you know, that's that sense of humour and that charm that comes across, if you remember, from that little clip.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's well worth it. I'll add it. I think it's on YouTube, so I'll add it to the episode notes alongside links as to how people can see the play as well. I mean, one of the things I liked about the Green character is that he asks the questions that I'd probably want to ask Philby. Because obviously you're having to imagine what those responses would be from his memoirs, which would obviously be quite, well, not quite, but obviously very favourable to what he did and sanctioned by the KGB. But things like, you know, how did he feel about betraying the men that he trained to go into Soviet Armenia and Albania?
Yes, well, obviously, you know, when Le Carre, for example, called him murderous, it was those things that he had in mind. I mean, none of Green's friends could understand why he stuck up for Philby, why he stayed friends with him. You know, no one could. I mean, in 87, at the time of this trip, A.N. Wilson wrote an article in the Mail in which he said that to go on holiday, as he put it, with Kim Philby, was like going on holiday with Goebbels during the Second World War. So, you know, this was the level of feeling against Green for continuing to associate in any way with Philby. And as you've just referred to, of the role Kim Philby played in the deaths of people who have estimated, you know, hundreds of agents, many of whom, this was these counter-revolutionary operations taking place in, you know, Albania, Ukraine, Georgia, Bulgaria, places like that. And when Philby at this time it was based in Istanbul, and he was our man in Istanbul and would train these people who he would then, send into these countries to try and stir up the counter-communist revolution. But obviously tipping off the Russians, who would in turn, you know, tip off the local authorities, and they would be killed. So, you know, that's quite an indictment, isn't it? That's quite something for us, a friend, to come to terms with. And, you know, I think Green, that is, even at Green's, you know, at the end of his life, his biographer, Norman Sherry, in fact, the very last thing, as Green was dying in Switzerland in the early 90s, you know, and Sherry would sort of still be on at him about, you know, but how can you stay, you know, but what about Philby? What are your last words on Philby? How can you, you know, justify, excuse, even explain this behavior? And he notes as well that this was apparently Ren Green really lost his rag over this. This is obviously just before he was dying, but, you know, it was the one thing that really upset him, and he refused to denounce Philby and got very angry because it was a sort of soft spot for him, and he struggled with it. I think, you know, if your friends do things, you know, you really disapprove of and violently, you know, that is a kind of dilemma for you, isn't it, as a person, how you handle when terrible things come out about friends. And, you know, and so that is an important aspect of the play that Green, he challenges about this. And I don't know whether he ever did this in real life. He does in the play.
Yeah, it's an interesting tale of how you navigate friendship like that when, yeah, your friend does things that you disagree with, and also if you've not seen them for a while as well. Whether you know the story of these two or not, it's a really interesting relationship that you see being played out. And while I was doing research for this, I discovered that Green had helped Fidel Castro in 1957.
Yes, he did. And Philby went to Cuba, one of the places, you know, he was able to go to having defected. And he was disappointed that he never did meet Castro. Green, as you say, did meet Castro more than one occasion, I think. I think got on quite well with him.
I think what he did is he supplied some warm clothes for the guerrilla fighters in 1957, so before he'd overthrown Batista. You know, it wasn't a major thing, but obviously there was that relationship with Castro and that sympathy for the Castro revolution.
Well, yeah, I mean, Green was very, he was very anti-fascist authoritarian regimes. He was very anti-American intervention, famously, of course, in his novel, The Quiet American, which so brilliantly anticipates. He wrote it in the mid-50s, and it brilliantly anticipates that, you know, the dangers of American intervention in Vietnam. So, and he spent many, you know, in his sort of later years, in Central and South America, you know, he was very much pro against Noriega in Nicaragua in favor of the Sandinistas. So, you know, he was very anti-fascist. He was anti-American intervention. He was quite anti. It's quite modern in being very sort of anti-empire and anti-colonialism and so forth. So he even famously said that he would, you know, if given the choice, he'd rather live in the Soviet Union than in America. I think he was being slightly provocative then, in that he was just trying to rile America, but he seemed to be perfectly happy living in the south of France. But, yeah. You know, as a bit of a tax exile, in fact,
yeah,
from Britain. But
He was probably thinking, oh, I know where there's a sofa I can sleep on in Moscow if need it.
Well, anyway, they had a lot in common with what they opposed, even though Green could never, despite this youthful prank of joining the Communist Party at Oxford for 4 weeks, he never became a communist, really. But they had a lot in common, really. I think Green called them, you know, we were both men of the left and anti-fascist as well.
I'm interested to know how the actors sort of prepared for this. Did you give them books that you wanted them to read to understand, or are they left to prepare themselves and read around the subject matter?
Yes. So, I mean, Oliver Ford Davis, who I've worked with twice before, 20 years ago or so, we did a play about Philip Larkin, and 10 years ago he played Balfour in a play I wrote about the Balfour Declaration, and he's a trained historian. He read history at Oxford, and I think he did a doctorate, and then he taught history at Edinburgh University as well. And it was only in his late 20s that he took the plunge and gave up being an academic, and, you know, decided to try his luck as an actor with great success. So, you know, this, I certainly don't need to give him any guidance in how to do the historical research. You know, he very much, you know, got into all that and read a huge amount, as he likes to do. And, of course, these documentaries that were very useful as well. There was also a late 60s documentary. Graham Greene always refused to appear on film. In fact, a few days ago, I read how Melvyn Bragg always, you know, says the one person he could never get to do the South Bank show was Graham Greene. And then when he met Graham Greene, Graham Greene said, well, you see, the problem is that I like to buy cheap secondhand books. And if I go on your show, I'll be recognized, and then they'll raise the price. So that was his witty way of getting out of being on the South Bank show. It's a great answer. But he did do a monitor in the late 60s, which we, through various contacts of the director, we managed to get hold of to watch that when Graham Greene took it. You never see him, but he takes a train ride and talks about his life. I think it goes on the Orient Express. That's a bit like Stamboul Train, one of his earlier books. There was that research. Stephen Boxer, also did lots of, you know, reading. There are these many, many biographies of Philby. I also particularly would like to mention, the Hugh Trevor Roper in the late 60s, also in 68, I think, wrote The Philby Affair, because he had known him, the famous historian Hugh Trevor Roper, who became Lord mm-hmm. Dacre. And then he wrote a very punchy a book about Philby, who he'd been a friend with and worked with at MI6. And that's very worth reading. But obviously more recently, Ben McIntyre has written a book, and there are lots of others. So, Stephen also got stuck in there. And we were very fortunate. One thing, actually, is that lockdown, the play was delayed 2 or 3 times, but it was fortunate that just before the end of last year, in fact, a new biography of Green was published by Richard Green, a Canadian, which is very good, actually. It's by far the best Green biography. And that was very useful for us to have time for Oliver Ford Davis and Alice Strachan and myself to sort of absorb that before rehearsals began. So I recommend that. Yeah, I recommend
that. Okay, well, we'll add that to this yes. ever-lengthening episode notes. Because I did find it interesting the relationship that Philby had with George Blake, the other major MI6 defector, which sort of fell apart over a incident with Philby's son.
Yes, no, this is true. Blake, who wasn't part of the Cambridge spy ring, the sort of Cambridge Five, you know, with Burgess and MacLean, both of whom defected but were dead by the time of the play, and Blunt, of course, stayed in Britain, and Philby and Cairncross. So Blake, though, had been famously given the longest sentence ever imposed in British law in the early 60s, but then escaped. Simon Gray wrote a play about this called Cellmates, that Stephen Fry famously vanished from. But being in Russia already, and Burgess has died, MacLean, and I think MacLean was still alive then, but obviously, you know, Philby had rather queered that by having an affair with his wife. So he was sort of thrown together with Blake. Although he hadn't known him in England, Blake wasn't sort of from the same kind of background as they were. He was, you know, he was Jewish. He was brought up in Egypt. He wasn't sort of part of that kind of posh establishment spy ring. But they did become friends, and it was, they sort of saw each other and had a lot in common, of course. But it was through Blake, though, that Philby met his wife, because his last Russian wife, because she was friends with Blake's wife. But yes, it wasn't long into their relationship that Blake and his wife threw a dinner party at their dacha, a lunch party, and Philby's son was over trying to make his way as a photographer. And Philby, you know, he asked if he could take some pictures. Philby said yes. And then Blake did as well. But then when John Philby, I think this is Charlotte's dad, went back to England, he of course sold the pictures, and they were published all over the Western world. And Blake was very angry about that, you know, and that, because he, I mean, you can see these pictures online of them having lunch in 75. And because he hadn't, I mean, he says, you know, even though he allowed the pictures to be taken, he'd never thought that they would be, you know, sold or published. But anyway, so that cooled relations between them, and they never recovered.
Yeah, because I get the impression that sort of Ruffina almost saved Philby, because he'd gone to quite a dark place after the previous affairs.
Yes, he did. In the late 60s, you know, he did. I think, you know, I mean, Burgess wasn't happy there at all either. There was a real, they weren't fully trusted. I think the Russians almost couldn't believe that these people were genuine, you know, that they were, you know, were they actually triple agents and so forth, you know, really working for the British, because, you know, it was such an extraordinarily successful operation, you know, the whole recruiting of these young undergraduates, really, or, you know, in the early 30s, who then became so successful that they could, you know, they sort of wondered whether they really were on their side. And so there was a sort of, it wasn't a total trust, even after that, you know, they're defected. So, you know, basically they didn't give them much to do, and they wouldn't let Philby publish his book initially. Philby's relationship, with Melinda MacLean collapsed. She had moved in for a while, and Eleanor had then sort of, you know, gone back to the West, and I think she went back to America, in fact, and she died. So he was lonely and depressed and bored and was drinking a lot. So it was a very dark time for him in the late, before he met Rufina, who really did, as you say, she really did save him. And she looked, I mean, she was 20 years younger. And she's, you know, she looked after him. She was hugely sympathetic to him. She was, he found her very attractive. He became very dependent on her, and he never learned the language either, Russian. He was quite, in later life, though, he became enormously dependent. And she really cared for him very much. So,
Lucky Kim again.
Yeah.
Cold War Conversations listeners can watch the play for only £12, discounted from £20. Just go to our episode notes at coldwarconversations.com/episode186. Now, you wouldn't be listening to this podcast without the generous support of our patrons. However, I want to especially thank our Politburo level members who are contributing a generous $30 a month to keep us on the air. They are Tony Sowards, Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, Jeffrey Jones, Matthew Comstock, Mark Labance, Frederick Esposito, Darren Hughes, Jim Black, Ryan Vlaming, Stephen Kovalich, and Peter Ryan. Don't forget, if you like one of those Cold War Conversations coasters and help support the show, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, please visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.